Picture three men. They are beyond sight or healthy diet. Isolated by a virus, they decide to turn to old TV for solace. Will they find comfort? Or will they find the Twilight Zone? Welcome again to the Twilight Zone. I'm your host, Nick Hoffman, and on panel this week we have...
Hello, this is Daniel, and I am not unconvinced that this is hell.
Matt.
Hey, Matthew W. Quinn, noted Atlanta horror author.
And John.
Hey, John here, and I am not a noted Atlanta horror author.
That's right. You can be.
Yeah, right. You notice last week we didn't have an episode of the Twilight Zone Zone. That's because we put out an exclusive just for our Patreon feed where Alien Resurrection is there. And if you become a member, Matt wrote a How I Would Have Done It for the Prescription, our Patreon-only newsletter. Matt, you want to give us a little tease? You
want to talk about Alien Resurrection at one point had a scene where Brad Dourif makes out with a xenomorph through glass. If I were doing this, I'd have kept that because that's a character moment.
And there would have been full penetration. So, I guess you're not in the Patreon, you're missing out. Please join us. There's hundreds of hours of content there that you should be a part of. In the meantime, we're here to talk about two episodes of The Twilight Zone going down that list. The first is A Nice Place to Visit, written by Charles Beaumont, not Rod Serling. And for all of those of you who have commented that you like the show, but it's Serling and not Sterling, I might eventually learn my lesson.
And if he doesn't, you can spank him.
It's Sterling.
Remember, the person making fun of our fans was Daniel. And Matt is so desperate for human interaction, he wants to spank me.
Oh, no, I'll leave that to our patrons. That would be the $500 a month perk.
That's right.
That's the top tier level of Patreon, spanking videos.
That's all gross.
But that's why it's funny.
As usual, I'm going to read the opening narration from Rod Serling, even though he didn't write it this time. Portrait of a man at work, the only work he's ever done, the only work he knows. His name is Henry Francis Valentine, but he calls himself Rocky, because that's the way his life has been. Rocky and perilous and uphill at a dead run all the way. He's tired now, tired of running or wanting, or waiting for the breaks that come to others but never to him. Never to Rocky Valentine, a scared, angry little man. He thinks it's all over now, but he's wrong. For Rocky Valentine, it's just the beginning. John, you're our guest here. Do you want to give us a plot synopsis?
Well, sure. This one, it starts out with Rocky robbing a bank, I believe. He's doing what he knows best, which is thievery. Of the federal crime type, and he's trying to escape when the police shoot him. He wakes up to a large man named Pip, dressed all in white, kind of nudging him, telling him to wake up. And he's in the world, but Pip is giving him all of his desires. So if he wants food, he gets food. If he wants money, he gets money. If he wants women or... gambling or what have you, a nice penthouse, he's got it. And so Pip is there for him. And so Rocky thinks, I'm dead, I've been shot, and this is heaven. I don't know what I did to deserve heaven, but here I am. And so it's an episode of him realizing exactly where he is. And I don't think I'm giving too much away from this, 60-year-old TV show, that it's not actually heaven, yeah. It's hell that he's at. Where when he spends a month or so getting everything he wants, he realizes this is boring. This is not what he wants. And the key line he says is, I don't want to be in heaven. I want to go to the other place. And Pip turns to him and laughs in that wicked Twilight Zone laugh and says, what makes you think you're in heaven? You are in the other place. And cue.
So like a lot of this Twilight Zone stuff, this actually started out as a radio drama for the Fleischmann's Yeast Hour.
The yeastiest.
That's right. This is the yeastiest plot we've done so far.
This is the dirtiest product we've had to promote.
It's pretty scandalous for the 50s.
It is. 1960, April 15th, 1960.
I'll be a pretentious history major and say the long 1960s. My 1960
would be the literal 1960s.
The long 1950s, I guess, until Kennedy's shot or something.
Oh, good Lord. Hey, can I jump in here for a minute? John, Nick, you're the fathers of toddlers. Did you recognize Pip?
Yes.
Did you recognize who Pip was?
Eventually, I looked it up, and then the voice became familiar to me, yes.
Right. I looked it up, too, but I had no reason to look it up, or no reason to recognize him. He's famous for two things. First and foremost, if you remember that Critic episode with Marlon Brando as Mr. French, he was the original Mr. French on Family Affair, whatever the hell that was. More importantly, he was Bagheera in the Jungle Book adaptation by Disney.
But Mowgli, this is the other place.
That's basically how the book ended, I think.
Yeah.
He was big with Disney in that time, wasn't he? Because I'm looking at his Wikipedia. He was the Sword in the Stone narrator. He was Bagheera in the Jungle Book, but then he was also the narrator in the Winnie the Pooh movies.
That's right.
Was he?
And Tigger 2.
He was. Every time he shows back up, he narrates Winnie the Pooh until he, I think he died in the 70s. So up through the second movie, The Many Adventures of Winnie the Pooh.
I trust you guys.
I think it was Mr. Belvedere who sat on his own testicles and it got his... the show cut down. He's also in Miracle on 34th Street, the original... Or no, that's not true. The 73.
He was in a lot of stuff. He was in the 1960 version of The Twilight Zone.
That's right. The Twilight Zone episode one.
Sorry, Time Machine. Time Machine.
Anyway, let's walk through this plot. It starts out, like John said, there's a robbery at a, I forget if it's a pawn shop or a bank, but essentially the cops try to catch him. He's making a break for it. We hear gunshots, but when he wakes up, he's fine. He's not covered in blood. There's not, the cops are gone. And a kind of austere man in white who goes by Pip essentially wakes him up. And when Rocky tries to rob him, Pip goes, "You don't want a wallet. You want cash. Here's money." And gives him $700, which thanks for inflation is like $6 million in cash or something.
Yeah, he was just pulling it out of his pocket.
Yeah.
I really like how this episode builds up to its conclusion. In other words, you kind of suspect what's happening, but they never say it until the absolute finale.
Well, and
yeah, also, I'd heard of this episode before, and I knew how it was going to end, and it is very, very well foreshadowed.
When I was a kid, we'd all watch those Treehouse of Horror episodes.
Yep.
And my dad would always explain, "Oh, that's a ripoff of an old Twilight Zone, like that episode where Homer went into 3D. It was Little Girl Lost from the Twilight Zone." The one thing they never did was this episode, and I remember my dad sitting us all down, well, me and my brother, and saying, "Oh, this is my favorite Twilight Zone ever." And I didn't realize it for many years, but he was talking about this episode.
Well, I mean, it's got an interesting premise. And for those of you who like Michael Shore's The Good Place, what's it? It's Kristen Bell. It's, I almost said Dan Aykroyd. Oh, God, what a terrible show that would be.
The guy from Cheers.
Ted Danson.
Yeah, that was the Dan that was stuck in my head. You know, when you've got that, it's the same idea. Although it's funny because you think the twist is that he's going to find out he's been dead all the time, but he figures that out in the first 10 minutes or so. He's like, "Oh, I'm dead."
Yeah, that's kind of what happens. You try and shoot an angel with a handgun.
That's true.
Yeah, he flat out shoots Pip at one point, doesn't he?
He sure does.
Here's one thing that confuses me. What's the nature of Pip? Was he a demon? Was he a human who died? What was he exactly?
I'm thinking he's a demon because he's indulging all of Rocky's vices. And then at the very end, when Rocky realizes he's in hell, Pip just starts laughing maniacally.
Yeah, I mean, he's a machination of whatever. We don't actually get any information on him. So I guess he's left up to our imagination, right? He's our conscience. He's our moral center. Again, it's kind of like, what's his name? Henry Bemis? Where it's like he made a wish to a djinn and everything came out exactly wrong, right? Oh, By the way, I noticed something today of all things. My toilet seat is Bemis brand. And I'm like, I just like the idea that someone was like, you know whose life was real piece of shit? Harold Bemis. Why don't we just name our toilets after them? I spent about 10 minutes laughing about that to myself today. I mean, honestly, so what are you saying? Like that this is his hell too?
He doesn't seem really concerned about that though. I mean, I definitely got the impression he was like Rocky's personal demon. He was there just for Rocky's torture.
I agree.
Well, as Queen said, Beelzebub has a devil put aside for me.
I guess we should progress the plot a little bit. After Rocky becomes suspicious that Pip is trying to swindle him, he, you know, hands out his wallet, gives him money, thinking that Pip is like trying to entice him to commit a crime. They go back to, I guess, Pip's apartment, or at least he thinks it's Pip's apartment. But then Pip says, look, no, this is your apartment. Everything's free. You could have all the booze. He picks up, like, he changes into like a kind of a sharp, lean suit. He even has, like, Matt, I guess, or whoever said it, he has Pip eat first, even though Pip hasn't eaten in, you know, centuries. You know, just to prove that the food's not poisoned, I guess. And then at that point, Rocky shoots him.
Does he shoot him? I mean, does he shoot him?
Yeah.
I thought that was later in the episode. I must be wrong.
It was later. It's not that much later, because I think it's not long after the food.
And
regardless, Pip is shown to be immortal, and this is actually a fanciful kind of place.
It's something like that. And he ends up with like three women at once, and they go to a casino and all this stuff so that he can win his own money.
And he wins every game.
And at this point, right, he, you know, says that the world is for Rocky alone. None of this stuff is real. And except for the two of them, no one in it is even real. Like, this is just kind of a machination. These are machines. These are automatons.
Before that, there's like a police officer patrolling in front of the casino. And then Rocky demands he be shrank to like 3 feet tall.
Yeah, so Rocky can hit him around.
Yeah, basically.
It's a very strange wish.
No, he was killed by a police officer. He seems to hate cops in general, calling them screws. So,
well, I think that was a subtle hint of where Rocky ended up. I mean, if this was supposed to be a paradise, then why would law enforcement be there at all?
Right. And at this point, it starts to break down because even Pip goes, do you want to lose the game sometime? You could lose the game sometime. Do you want to, like, how hard do you want life to be, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, and have so we gone to the Hall of Records yet?
Well, that's the next step, I guess.
Yeah, because he's wondering why he's in heaven and thinks he must have done something at some point to earn it. And so Pip takes him to the Hall of Records. And he was a problem since he was like six.
Right. His first entry is killed a dog.
Or what, the Angel Street Gang?
We have like a little Jeffrey Dahmer here just walking around killing like all the animals in his apartment complex at the age of seven in a sauce pot full of penises. I mean, it's so funny because it's effectively the Groundhog Day, but with a criminal instead of a sociopath. You know, potato, or tomato, tomato, I guess is what I almost said, but didn't.
Well, that happens before the big twist. He's reviewing his record and Pip's like laughing at him going, oh, there's no possible mistake. At the end of that, Rocky's like, well, if it doesn't bother the big guy, it's not going to be a problem for me. And then he goes on his way. And then it's like a month later where we get the twist.
We can start wrapping up this episode here at this point. But like, at this point, Rocky realizes he's, you know, kind of in hell. And, or no, specifically they say the other place, which again kind of leads credence back to the Michael Shore good place kind of comparison, because it is very straightforward. And Pip, who again, you can hear his voice, you know, it was a particularly blustery day. You know, it's the Bagheera voice. It's the narrator from Sword in the Stone, and also the dumb older brother. And he's just kind of got this deep, warm voice, but he turns and he gets the line, heaven, what gave you the idea you were in heaven, Mr. Valentine? This is the other place. And you're just like, oh, shit.
And he's laughing maniacally. Like, he is having fun at that point.
Yeah.
That's why I thought he was a demon.
It's a very Sisyphean kind of idea. Like, you're going to keep trying to do what you were doing, and it's not going to get you anywhere. It's a beautiful, ironic punishment. Again, it smacks of Time Enough at Last.
Or The Simpsons Halloween, where he has to eat donuts forever.
That's right.
That's not wrong.
Have all the donuts in the world.
What really drove the point home for me is the bit where Pip's tempting Rocky into robbing another bank. And then Rocky asks, is there a chance I could get caught? Mm-hmm. And then Pip's like, well, of course, if that's what you want. There's no chaos in this world. There's nothing that people usually measure their accomplishments on, which is that they actually have to do something.
Yeah, there's no risk. It's all made to exactly what he wants.
Yeah, exactly. Man, I was looking up Rod Serling, and he died at the age of 50 in 1975. He was 26 when this episode came out. The fact that he looks 50 is because he smoked 4 packs a day, it says. But I looked because apparently in the original, Mickey Rooney was going to play Valentine. And in the memo they sent to CBS, Beaumont suggested that if Mickey Rooney wasn't available, that Rod Serling should act. Although Rod Serling ends up being in the episode Night of the Jockey, and he also ends up in the an episode that we're doing for next week's show. But yeah, no, it was great. And by the by, because apparently wigs don't exist for men back then, Cabot bleached his hair, and it took it like 3 months to return. So there you go. I guess it was really worth it.
If you look at pictures of him in Family Affair, he's got really, really dark hair.
Well, he just wanted to be satanic Colonel Sanders that much.
Apparently, CBS standards flagged this episode. And apparently people didn't trust Rod Serling. He was anti-war. He was anti-racism, you know. And so people were really suspicious of him in later episodes. Yeah, I know, right? Someone on the right side of history. But anyway, this one is particularly flagged because it was highly sexualized. He asked, the girls asked him if they could go to the ball with him. And as Matt quoted, he wanted a broad who was really stacked. Which, again, it seems almost cute by today's standards. But, you know, I digress. I think we're about done with this one. So we'll take a break. You'll hear the interstitial music, and we'll come back with the second episode.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound. A dimension of sight. A dimension of mind. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the Twilight Zone.
Before we move on, I realized I forgot to do the closing narration because I'm an idiot and I always forget this stuff. So it ends with a scared, angry little man who never got a break. Now he has everything he's ever wanted, and he was going to have to live with it for eternity in the Twilight Zone. So this brings us to our next episode, episode 34 of the first season, The After Hours, which comes directly from one of Rod Serling's plots, again, a radio plot, which we talked about before. With the music from Bernard Herrmann, of all people. If you guys don't know Bernard Herrmann, he did most of Alfred Hitchcock stuff, including Psycho and things like that.
There was a general lack of music in this
episode. That's what made it so creepy, especially in the end. So the Psycho sound guys involved with it, that makes sense.
Yeah, it is. It's a good use of minimal score. It's very subtle. It's very moving. I think it works very well. But yeah, so let's do this thing. So this one has an opening narration in two parts. We see a woman, blonde, wearing a kind of white blouse, and it goes, express elevator to the 9th floor of a department store, carrying Miss Martha White on a most prosaic, ordinary, run-of-the-mill errand. She then rides to the top floor, and the narration comes back. Miss Martha White on the 9th floor, specialties department, looking for a gold thimble. The odds are she'll find it, but the odds there are even better odds that she'll find something else. Because this isn't just a department store. This happens to be the Twilight Zone.
So she's how browsing prosaic, ordinary, and run-of-the-mill is looking for a gold thimble? Is that something people did?
I think it's more about department store culture, by which I mean those were still relatively new at the time, and you could find anything.
I mean, you're possible. And this is, you know, your standard kind of any town USA, any metropolis USA, eight-story giant Harrods in London-style department store where you can kind of buy everything in one store in a way that really doesn't exist anymore. Anyway, Matt, you want to give us a plot synopsis?
Okay, there's this woman who who's trying to go buy a gold thimble, and she ends up on the deserted ninth floor where this mysterious dark-haired woman gives her the gold thimble, but when she makes it back to the main floor, it's damaged, and everyone is telling her there is no ninth floor, and I think getting kind of gaslighting here. She started to go a little crazy. Then she passes out, and they leave her in an office, and I guess they must all forget about her, because when she wakes up, the store is closed, and she can't get out, and the elevator takes her back to the ninth floor. Dun, 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 dun.
This one overall is one that really like sticks with me. I don't know why. It's an interesting twist. We're back in the capable hands of Rod Serling, coming up with like a kind of unusual claustrophobic kind of story, you know, has kind of a unique point of view on all of this.
And unlike the last one we watched, the Nice Place to Visit, this one isn't dependent upon a sudden twist sentence at the very end. This one has the creepiness and the tension going throughout, where we're joined by, like, we join Marcia in her uncertainty, her confusion, her paranoia as to what's going on. I thought it was very well done. And like we said earlier, like there's very little music to accompany this. So we are given just as much confusion as she is throughout the entirety of the episode.
And I mean, Matt's outline was, you know, spot on. It's very straightforward. But like what you don't get from it is the building horror. She goes up to this floor. It's abandoned. It immediately feels uncomfortable, you know, like it's one of those things that I don't know about the rest of you. I've seen on YouTube where it's like, check out this abandoned blank. It looks like it has all the trappings of something that should exist, but it's empty except for this one woman wearing a flared jacket that, and I don't remember if she's looking specifically for the thimble or specifically for a gift for her mother. And this is what she happens to find, like the shelf with the one thing that would be a fine gift. The gift that would be like just a perfect nothingness. Everything goes wrong, as Matt alluded to. As she returns down, she notices that it's scuffed and dented and wants to exchange it. And apparently no one knows what she's talking about. You know, at this point, this is where the episode starts to be something, of course, right? Like, yeah, the kind of initial turn happens when she's on an empty floor. She doesn't know if the world's crazy or they're just giving her the runaround. Because at first she's not paranoid. She's kind of pissed off that it seems like she's being played. Matt, you said catfished. I think that's a perfect way to put it.
Well, it's one of the feminist horror themes that was in Rosemary's Baby later and the new Invisible Man that came out.
Can you expand on that, Daniel?
Well, I could. I mean, everyone's gaslighting the main character. No one believes her and no one attempts to understand what's going on with her. They're just like,
yeah, they're all dude.
Poor girl. We don't have a ninth floor in this department store. Mm. I mean, in all the classic feminist horror movies, which of course I'm an expert on because I'm a white guy, that's just always been the most horrifying thing. You're telling people the truth and no one believes you.
Yeah, the actress is named Anne Francis, who... I mean, is one of these kind of, you know, blonde bombshell types that appears in a lot of stuff in the 50s and 60s.
Well, I was going to make a comment.
Oh, yeah, she was in the Forbidden Planet.
If there's any Blessing of the Pets involved.
She was born 15 years before all that. Anyway, doesn't matter. She was in Forbidden Planet as the blonde alien that they discover on the island, or on the planet. She was on A Bad Day at Black Rock with Spencer Tracy. She was around for a long time, and she showed up here and there now and again, including on the Drew Carey Show. so why not? Yeah, remember when the Drew Carey Show was a thing? At this point,
well, I lived in Cleveland at the time, so I had to watch.
Oh, no kidding!
It was fun.
It was fine
for what it was.
There's a lot of gray comedy nonsense that happens in the '90s. I remember it. Then eventually, it just got silly, right? They would be like, "We're going to do this one live, and it's going to be three different live shows nationwide." You're just like, "All right, I just want you to be funny for me."
Wasn't that an Arrested Development
hard, Drew Carey Show
episode where they were like trying all the gimmicks that sitcoms usually did?
Yeah. I mean, I believe it. They did a lot on that show. By the end, I think it ultimately fell apart.
Just like any other show, like Friends and How I Met Your Mother. And like they eventually just tried every gimmick they could.
And I think they all eventually, especially of those, Arrested Development, How I Met Your Mother, and hell, even Archer, where it becomes so self-referential to the jokes that it made over the last 6 years that like you skip it and try to come back to it. It's impossible. So why would I even bother?
Right.
But anyway.
Anyway, this show.
Ultimately.
Twilight Zone.
Right. That's right.
Well, actually, I remember this episode. Does anybody remember Bongo Comics?
That's a bad grading.
Right, exactly. I swear there was like a Bartman comic or something where he was talking about the things that scared him as a kid. This episode was one of them because he was vague. He was just like the Twilight episode where the mannequin comes to life, but I don't know. I can kind of see that seeing on this episode, especially when the main character's on the top floor and they're like, "You remember who you are? You remember who are you?"
Yeah, and that's where we can get to the really kind of creepy turn here, right? So there's kind of like...
Well, the elevator takes her back to the ninth floor and she runs around in total silence. Except for like knocking things over, and it is so freaky.
Right. Well, and I mean, what I wanted to get to too is like, again, kind of what Daniel was alluding to, the complete dismissiveness of everyone. Like, there's this kind of fey, like I guess floor manager or buyer who's asking her like, "Well, why don't you just go take it back to where you bought it from?" And there's no one there. There's not even a ninth floor, and the manager, who's essentially dealing with, I mean, it's 1960. It's a hysterical woman, whatever you want to say, right? And she takes a nap and wakes up later, then finds her way back to the ninth floor to find this wasteland.
Kind of remind me of Alex's teacher in A Clockwork Orange.
Totally.
Well, it is kind of a feminist horror thing. You know, they don't care about her.
Yeah, she doesn't matter at all. I guess, ultimately, this is where things get very, very bizarre, right? This is where the true Twilight Zone hits, which is what is real at all. I mean, when we go to the ninth floor, the elevator literally goes off the top number on the kind of handle at the top. And when she gets there, it is an empty room, except for it's filled with mannequins, which weren't mannequins there before. The mannequins we saw throughout the store. And the breadcrumb trail led by Serling here is that the mannequins do seem to be constantly in a different place. And by the end, when they're all up there, things are very unsettling. John or Matt, you want to round us out here?
Let's let John go.
She's hearing voices. She's walking through this crowd of mannequins. They're all kind of calling out to her and not moving. Then they do move when she walks past them. They come to life. Kind of, we see it, but she doesn't see it. We see Marcia walking through this room, and as she walks past all these mannequins, they start following her and whispering to her. We see the woman from before, at the very beginning of the show, who sold her the thimble, essentially telling her, "Don't you remember? You're one of us. You're only supposed to be alive for 1 month out of the year, and then you're supposed to come back. But right. You overstayed your time. And you've forgotten who you are."
Here's the thing about this episode that I'm still confused about. She was always on about buying a golden thimble for her mother and making sure that it was perfect. If she's a mannequin who's only been alive for like 30 days, who's her mom? What's her job? Where's she living? They never explain any of that.
Well, yeah, we're not told any of the details of her life outside
Daniel,
of the...
Daniel, that's what we call a plot hole.
The department store.
That's the point. It's that, I mean, if you want to get really, really meta, this is an example of the man in the gray flannel suit, right? We as middle-class people are supposed to act in a certain way, so of course you would go to a department store to buy a gift for your mother. You don't even have to think about it. It's an excuse to get out of the house, which I totally, totally understand. The in-between stuff, of course, also doesn't matter because, as we'll get to in an episode coming up, she's just a character in search of a plot. Therefore, the reveal that she's a mannequin or whatever makes perfect sense because her story doesn't matter. It doesn't matter at all. It's because it's all been a farce. She is the farce itself, and now she's returning. It's as almost as though Rod Serling himself has a character, like an addict filled with characters, and it was her turn to come out.
Yeah, everyone is so nice about it, like, oh, it's no problem, you're just a day late.
But yeah, so the only other weird... Being late at the end of the month always has very different connotations. I also think that's Rod Serling having a little jab for fun. But if you dig this, Anne Francis is... Well, it ends, by the way, I guess we should get to the epilogue, right as the closing narration starts to kick in, where Armbruster, or whatever his name is, the shopper that walks around the floor manager, walks by a mannequin who looks almost exactly like her, and he gives it kind of a double look, glances back over his shoulder, kind of shakes it off, and walks away when the narration comes in. Marcia White, in her normal and natural state. A wooden lady with a painted face who 1 month out of the year takes on the characteristics of someone as normal and flesh and blood as you or I. But it makes you wonder, doesn't it? Just how normal are we? Just who are the people we nod our hellos as we pass on the street? A rather good question to ask, particularly in the Twilight Zone.
Great episode.
Yeah, and the head, if you're interested, showed up in the MGM short film, The King of the Duplicators. I don't know what that means, but there you have it. And they remade this one in the 1986 revival. Yeah, don't even pretend like you know what King of the Duplicators is. It sounds like a shitty Batman 66 villain, doesn't it?
I wonder if Calvin and Hobbes is involved.
I'm pretty sure that was Lewis Black's character in Harvey Birdman.
The Deadly Duplicator, my friend. The Deadly Duplicator. It is now traditional on this weird show that we are desperately trying to make work to decide which of the two episodes was the better episode. I'll go last. I'll let our guests go first. John, which of the two did you think was a better episode?
I liked the After Hours. It was, as far as TV goes, I thought it was more horror, more suspense. It was better written. The nice place to visit what was fun, but it entirely hinged on that last sentence. Like, that was the only thing that made it the Twilight Zone. And, you know, I don't know about audiences in 1959, but I wasn't terribly thrilled with it. So, yeah, the After Hours was more, almost like Hitchcock. It was more theater, better made.
Well done. I agree. Matt, what do you got?
If I hadn't known about the plot twist, The Nice Place to Visit already, I probably would have liked it better. But After Hours, like this total silence when Marcia is running around the ninth floor, that was spooky. Mm-hmm. Although I will give the actor who played Pip credit for A Nice Place to Visit. He is doing a really good job and having lots of fun.
Excellent. Daniel.
This might be rather myopic of me, but I still want to go with A Nice Place to Visit because that's how I was introduced to the show mainly. Besides Treehouse of Horror, this was what my dad explained to me what the Twilight Zone was all about. Now, the After Hours is great. I remember seeing that on a New Year's Day special that was running on the Sci-Fi Channel back in the day. And like I said, I remember reading about that in Bongo Comics, and Matt Groening was saying this was one of the creepiest things he ever saw. I know I'm the minority. I'm going with A Nice Place to Visit as the better episode.
I will say it's interesting at this point because we've done four episodes of this. This is the fourth, and that means eight total Twilight Zone episodes. This is the second one where death is somehow personified. And, just to compare it to One for the Angels, I think it's very interesting because there's one person fighting death, one person who's almost embracing death in a weird way, So I give it credit. I will, though, say it's weird because The Good Place has kind of not ruined it, but really taken that idea to task. And possibly because it's not a Rod Serling episode, it just doesn't feel as Twilight Zone-y to me. That being said, I think The After Hours is the stronger episode. Not by much, but that ending, man, that ending is something, like, I don't know. It's really unsettling. It's really creepy. Yeah, no, I think I'm going to pick the second one only because watching it every time, there's something really bone-chilling about how at first it's so freaky, and then she kind of accepts it. Like, oh, I'm so sorry. You're just like, wait. No. You can't just be nothing. But anyway.
For such a creepy episode, it's such a cheerful ending.
It is. I guess in feminist film, it would also be, now, ma'am, you know your place. Why don't you go back to your place? And so she accepts it willingly. Very 1950s. Anyway, so with that in mind, tune in next week, where hopefully we'll have John Guest again. And we will be doing two episodes. We've left season one, finally. We will do the last episode of season one, A World of His Own, followed by season two episode, The Howling Man. So, you know, stay tuned next week when we re-enter the Twilight Zone. The Twilight Zone Zone is a production of Dude Letter Podcasting and Myopia Defend Your Childhood. It is hosted by Nick Hoffman, paneled by Daniel S. and Matt Quinn. It is edited by Nick and Daniel. The theme song is Six Impromptus, Opus 5, Impromptu 5 by Jean Sibelius. The list is from Vanity Fair, the 26 episodes we talk about when we talk about The Twilight Zone by Donald Liebenson. The Twilight Zone is created, hosted, and mostly written by Rod Serling. The Twilight Zone and all clips are owned by CBS Television and Cayuga Productions.